it's not a complete victory for Alaska Native rural subsistence rights. That work remains to be done.
The U.S. Supreme Court lets the Katie John subsistence case stand. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Superior Court judge reverses Dillingham's annexation of Nooshigak Bay.
I think the judge did a real good job of understanding the facts and applying the law, and it's, of course, a decision that we agree with.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation for the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 1st and 2nd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Learn how Alaska can become a world leader in this fast-growing industry. Early registration ends March 28th. More information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
The Katie John lawsuit over subsistence fishing rights is finally over. The U.S. Supreme Court announced today it will not review a lower court's decision to leave standing federal rules that provide a rural subsistence priority on 60% of Alaska's inland waters. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Alaska Federation of Natives President Julie Kitka says it's a victory for natives and rural residents who Kitka says rely on the subsistence harvest for their physical and cultural existence.
We are pleased with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision today. This should end 19 years of litigation.
Kitka says she hopes it marks the beginning of a better relationship with the state government, which, in the eyes of subsistence advocates, has aggressively fought harvest rights guaranteed in federal law. When he announced the appeal last year, State Attorney General Michael Garrity said the rules erode the principle that Alaskans, not the federal government, should manage their own fish and game. It was the primary reason Alaska fought to become a state. The AG's spokeswoman, Corey Mills, said today the decision leaves in place a muddled system of dual federal-state management.
It's just going to continue to lead to litigation and further uncertainty to what we believe is the detriment of all Alaskans because the lines just won't be clear.
At the heart of the long-running subsistence conflict is a disagreement between federal and state law. Federal law says rural subsistence users in Alaska have priority rights to fish and hunt on public lands, while the state constitution forbids discriminating between urban and rural residents. To provide the rural preference, the federal government took over fisheries management on federal land in 1999. Heather Kendall Miller, who represented Katie John as senior staff attorney for the Native American Rights Fund, says winning the case isn't the end of the story because there's still no rural subsistence priority in areas where the state has jurisdiction.
It's not a complete victory for Alaska Native rural subsistence rights. That work remains to be done and probably will only be accomplished through legislation.
Ideally, Kendall Miller says, Alaskans would amend the state constitution to add a subsistence priority.
Well, the other alternative is to adopt federal legislation that would make the priority extend through all lands in Alaska.
The case began in the 1980s when Athabascan elder Katie John wanted to fish at a traditional fish camp on the Copper River, a spot the state had closed to fishing. John died last year at age 97. Her granddaughter, Catherine Martin, says she's been hearing from supporters all day on Facebook. Martin says she can imagine her grandmother's reaction.
She probably would have just, finally, I'm done, no more, good.
In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The 2012 annexation of Nooshigak Bay into the city of Dillingham has been overturned by the local Superior Court judge. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
The Alaska Local Boundary Commission approved the city of Dillingham's annexation of 369 square miles of Nooshigak Bay back in December of 2011. The city wanted to bring the bay into the city limits so that they could impose a 2.5% local fish tax on all of the salmon caught commercially in the Nooshigak Commercial Fishing District. The city believes the money would help pay for city services used by many of the fishermen who fish each summer in the Nooshigak District, including the bay's only harbor, the local landfill, and police and fire services. The annexation was approved by the voters in Dillingham in April of 2012. The native village of Ekuk, which is essentially an unpopulated village for most of the year, has been fighting the annexation since the beginning, and they appealed the annexation decision to the Superior Court. James Baldwin is the attorney hired to represent Ekuk.
I think the judge did a real good job of understanding the facts and applying the law, and it's, of course, a decision that we agree with.
The oral arguments in the case were held back in October. Everyone involved had to wait until Thursday for the decision from Superior Court Judge Pat Douglas. She found that the Local Boundary Commission abused its discretion in not requiring the City of Dillingham to process its annexation petition according to the legislative review method instead of the local option, which was chosen by the city and approved by the LBC. Baldwin says that's what the native village of Ekuk argued for.
Since what was happening here was the annexation of unoccupied territory, it couldn't have happened according by using the local option method, because there's a statute involved here that pretty plainly states that you have to have an election in both areas if you're going to have something done by local action.
Taken on face value, Thursday's decision seems to vacate the approved annexation of the Nooshigat Commercial Fishing District and the 2.5% local fish tax imposed by Dillingham voters when they approved the annexation back in 2012. If that's correct, then the Nooshigat District goes back to being the only commercial fishing district in Bristol Bay that is not owned by a municipality and that does not feature a local fish tax. It's possible the City of Dillingham or the Local Boundary Commission could appeal Judge Douglas's decision to the Alaska Supreme Court. If the city or state chooses not to appeal, then the city's annexation petition goes back to the Local Boundary Commission. Specifically, Judge Douglas remanded the petition back to the commission for processing by legislative review. If Dillingham's annexation petition is eventually placed before the members of the Alaska legislature, it's unlikely that it will happen this year. The established protocol is for the Local Boundary Commission to present a petition for legislative review during the first 10 days of a session. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will review whether or not Southeast Alaska wolves should be listed for protection under the Endangered Species Act. The federal agency this month announced what's called a positive 90-day finding on a petition to list the Alexander Archipelago wolf. From Petersburg, KFSK's Joe Vicknicki reports.
Steve Brockman is Southeast Alaska coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
We determined that there was substantial information presented, enough to make us think we probably should do a real status review.
Brockman says that status review will look at the best available information on wolf populations. The timing of when that review happens also depends on funding granted by Congress, which limits the number of petitions the agency can review each year.
Recently, that has been several years before we get that funding, so we do have an opportunity here to, well, really take advantage of the time lag to get some conservation in place so that we don't have to list the wolf. Honestly, the Fish and Wildlife Service would prefer to leave management of the wolf with the state of Alaska where it belongs.
The petition to list the wolves was submitted in August of 2011 by two groups, the Center for Biological Diversity and Greenpeace. Larry Edwards is a forest campaigner with Greenpeace in Sitka.
Well, we're thrilled to finally have the finding. It has come over 2 years late, but We knew there was a strong case for pursuing a listing, and we're glad to see that the agencies decided that our petition had merit.
The groups argue that the region's wolf populations are declining and are vulnerable to hunting and trapping pressure, along with the loss of habitat from logging on the 17-million-acre Tongass National Forest. In particular, they cite past and future logging on Prince of Wales Island and say wolves on that island are in danger of extinction. State and federal managers closed hunting and trapping seasons in late March on Prince of Wales because hunters and trappers had reached a target number of wolves on the island. That's a concern for Edwards.
We have some great concerns about how the harvest cap was set for that. We think it was set way too high and that the illegal take of wolves wasn't adequately taken into account. So there are some significant management problems, both in terms of logging and I think how Fish and Game has been managing as well.
The groups also say two intensive management programs authorized by the state's Board of Game last year for areas near Ketchikan and Petersburg will put further pressure on wolf numbers. Doug Vincent Lang is director for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation. He says Fish and Game believes the department has sustainably managed wolf populations in the region.
We're confident that any potential conservation concerns can be adequately addressed through existing mechanisms, including state regulatory mechanisms that are out there. And given that, we don't believe that wolves in southeast Alaska are at risk now or threatened with the risk of extinction in the foreseeable future. And as such, we don't believe that there's a justification for a 90-day positive finding for wolves in southeast Alaska, and we're disappointed with the service's decision.
The intensive management programs could eventually mean state-sponsored trapping of wolves in the two areas of southeast, designed to improve the number of wolves' main prey, deer. Vincent Lang notes the two intensive management programs have not yet been implemented.
Part of the reason is that we're collecting additional information both on deer and wolf in those two very small areas where the board had approved intensive management programs for the department to conduct once we had that baseline information. We've invested a significant amount of money in the next 3 or 4 years to inform the development of a status review, which this 90-day finding kicks off in terms of looking at wolf abundance, wolf distribution, and wolf genetic structures in southeast Alaska.
The federal agency's finding kicks off a 60-day public comment period on March 31st. Fish and Wildlife will be seeking input and information on southeast wolves. At a later date, the federal agency then begins a 12-month status review, which leads to a decision on whether the animals should be listed as threatened or endangered or not. The agency already determined a listing was not warranted for a prior petition submitted during the 1990s. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicknicki.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, two pieces of legislation with an Alaska Native theme get very different reactions.
The Native people here, we're not from another country. We were here before.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
An ordinance now before the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly would allow the borough to pay for advertising to influence voters in the case of state ballot propositions. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the ordinance comes at a time when an upcoming state ballot is expected to put a number of controversial issues before the voters.
The ordinance, sponsored by Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assemblyman Ron Arvin, comes up for public comment Tuesday night at the regular Borough Assembly meeting. Alaska Code prohibits boroughs from spending money on advertising concerning a candidate or a ballot initiative, but state law does allow boroughs or municipalities to pass a local law that allows the governing entity to spend money to influence the outcome of a ballot proposition vote. Arvin's ordinance would revise the Matsu Borough Code, which currently forbids spending borough money on election advertising, to allow the borough to spend taxpayer money to influence voters on statewide ballot propositions. Arvin did not return calls or emails for this story, but in the ordinance he states that a revision of the current code would allow the borough to take a position for or against a statewide ballot proposition. Matsu Borough Assemblyman Jim Sykes says the proposed ordinance is a bad idea.
I have more questions than I have answers here, but why would we use taxpayer dollars to try and influence a state ballot issue that specifically gives Alaskans the responsibility to vote on it?
Sykes also says it's up to statewide voters to make decisions on state ballot issues and that the borough government should not interfere.
We are essentially taking a position, creating propaganda, and spending borough money, which we don't have any extra on, to do propaganda on an issue that is beyond our responsibility.
Arvin's ordinance states that all voters are impacted by statewide ballot issues, and that his ordinance would allow the borough to state how the outcome of a ballot proposition would affect borough voters. Sykes says many areas of the proposed ordinance are murky. For instance, who in the borough would decide on the opinion the borough would take in regard to any state ballot issue? And Sykes says the proposed ordinance raises reporting issues with the Alaska Public Offices Commission and with the requirements to list which major donors pay for election advertising. Arvin's ordinance states that borough funds used to influence voter response to a state ballot proposition must be specifically appropriated for that purpose. Using borough money on candidate election advertising is prohibited under state law. Arvin is seeking state office. He has declared his candidacy to run for Bill Stoltz's House District 11 seat. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The 2014 Sitka Sound sacro herring fishery is over. The 48 permit holders caught the last remaining fish in this year's harvest limit, and then some, in a wild 45-minute opener Saturday afternoon right in front of downtown Sitka. The preliminary estimate from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game brings this year's total catch to 17,200 tons, about 900 tons more than the guideline harvest level. The final harvest numbers will be known once processing is complete. In both 2012 and 13, seiners undershot their harvest limit significantly as widespread spawning occurred just as fishing started. ADF&G will continue to conduct aerial surveys of the shoreline as the spawn progresses. At last word, there were 3.8 nautical miles of spawn. The herring typically continue spawning into late April, depositing eggs along 70 to 80 miles of beach. Meanwhile, the traditional subsistence harvest of roe on hemlock and roe on kelp is beginning in earnest in the areas around Middle Island. Today is the deadline to sign up for health insurance and avoid a penalty under the Affordable Care Act. Insurance is available through multiple sources, from private carriers to publicly funded providers like Medicaid. But Alaska is among many states that have so far declined to expand Medicaid, and as KUAC's Dan Brosh reports, it's created a coverage gap.
The Affordable Care Act makes health insurance available to more Americans and helps many pay for it, but some low-income Alaskans are finding themselves left out.
It doesn't make rational sense. It's ludicrous, it's ironic, and it's cruel.
Hillary Houghton lives a semi-subsistence life in Fairbanks, cutting wood to keep her cabin warm and patching together a small income she says falls short of a $14,300 Affordable Care Act assistance threshold.
At that level, my premium would be covered at 100%, and my total out-of-pocket per year would be $250. And this was a sock in the gut because I had no idea what I was missing.
Medicaid could provide a safety net for Houghton, but Alaska's so far refused federal assistance to expand the program to cover people in her situation. Governor Sean Parnell has cited a lack of trust that federal subsidies will continue in already massive Medicaid expenses. A state-funded study estimated that more than 20,000 people may be in Houghton's situation. Cassie Toth, a certified Affordable Care Act application counselor at Interior Community Health in Fairbanks, won't estimate how many of those she's helped fall into the so-called donut hole.
You know, I see a lot of low-income people, and I've seen a lot of people that are falling in the subsidy range, so it's really hard to say.
Toth says the system offers little for those who don't qualify because of the income guidelines.
There's exemptions from the fine for not having health insurance. If they really wanted health insurance, they could pay full price for health insurance, but most people can't afford that.
Toth says her schedule is booked, meeting with people trying to apply for insurance before Monday's sign-up deadline, but Interior Community Health is offering an all-day enrollment event on the 31st. The Parnell administration has tasked the State Department of Health with better defining who's falling between cracks in the system, a puzzle Deputy State Director of Healthcare Policy Josh Appleby describes as complicated by the mix of insurance options and qualification requirements.
Whether it be income eligibility, whether it means that they are unregistered VA eligibles who can register and be certified by the VA for care but haven't yet, whether they are beneficiaries of the tribal health system, what you're talking about is finding individuals who have very specific cases that put them either in an eligible category or an ineligible category.
Appleby defines the system gaps as narrow and says privacy protections keep the state from examining eligibility for coverage under state offerings like the Chronic and Acute Medical Assistance, or CAMA, program for low-income disease sufferers.
That is triggered not only by income, but it's also the type of health care that's needed. And so without getting, you know, really into each individual specific situation, you have to make general assumptions.
Appleby says that's not an accurate way to analyze what's going on, adding that Affordable Care Act applications should help determine the size and circumstances of the donut hole population.
I think what we're going to find is a way to look at our data differently based on the people who came forward for the exchange and didn't fall into the Medicaid bucket and didn't get into the exchange under a subsidized plan.
Appleby says the information will enable the Parnell administration and a recently named Medicaid Reform Advisory Group to target program fixes to bring those left out under some sort of affordable coverage. That can't happen soon enough for people like Hillary Houghton.
I just can't believe how far out of the loop some of us are by virtue of our lifestyle choice, our income status, our circumstances.
Houghton, who has health problems, says she's being extra careful, knowing she can't afford an emergency room visit without some level of insurance. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly has approved an up to $7.5 million line of credit for the Interior Gas Utility. The loan fund is for the borough-created IGU to begin preliminary work on local gas distribution piping in anticipation of LNG being trucked to town from the North Slope via the state's Interior Energy Project. Speaking at last Thursday's assembly meeting, IGU Board Chairman Bob Shefchik described the borough loan as bridge funding for the nonprofit utility.
Essentially act as the cash flow in advance of gas arriving, and so it would be used as any business would use their cash flow or operating capital.
The Interior Energy Project will be largely state-financed, and Shefchik said the borough line of credit will be there to allow IGU to advance while state financing is in the works. The line of credit will tap a more than $25 million borough fund, which includes a $7.8 million influx from a recent ruling in a Trans-Alaska Pipeline property tax assessment case. Fairbanks resident Ron Kovalek spoke in opposition to giving such money to the IGU.
Should go back to the voters. It shouldn't be touched. It should be packed back to the people who've been carrying the burden all of these years.
Some assembly members stress that any money loaned to the IGU will be repaid with interest. The panel ultimately voted 7-1 in support of the ordinance setting up the line of credit for the IGU. Two bills dealing with Alaska Native issues got different receptions from members of the legislature last Thursday. At least three House lawmakers were skeptical of a bill that would make 20 Alaska Native languages official state languages. About an hour later, they joined the rest of their House colleagues in voting unanimously for a bill honoring the late Reverend Walter Sobeleff. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
House Bill 217 would make November 14th Walter Sobeleff Day in Alaska. That was the day the Tlingit cultural and spiritual leader was born in 1908 in the now-abandoned village of Killisnoo near Angoon. Sobeleff spent most of his life in Juneau, where he established a ministry that welcomed people of all races at a time when the town was segregated. He died in 2011 at the age of 102. Juneau Representative Kathy Munoz's family belonged to Sobeleff's church.
His words, his deeds, his presence were imbued with a strong sense of grace. He often spoke of unity and respect and tolerance.
Munoz was one of several House members to share personal stories about Sobolev, who often served as legislative chaplain. As the youngest member of the legislature, Sitka Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins never got to meet Sobolev. Christ Tompkins says he learned about him by watching videos on the internet.
I think it's fitting, just as this bill will continue to honor his legacy in years to come. His wisdom has been preserved courtesy of the wonders of technology.
With Sobolev's four children watching from the gallery, the House passed the bill 35-0. It now heads to the Senate. The Native Languages Bill got hung up in the House State Affairs Committee amid concerns from some Republican members about how it would be interpreted by future legislatures or the courts. Supporters say House Bill 216 would recognize the efforts of people working to preserve Alaska Native languages, many of which have lost or are losing their last fluent speakers. But Representative Doug Isaacson from North Pole said he wanted to make sure the bill's intent was clear before he could support it.
So that we don't have compounding results from a law where a future legislature might be encumbered with having to provide everything in 20 different languages, for example.
Wasilla Representative Wes Keller wondered if there was a better way to support those working to save native tongues.
Like we could have a day, that honors the native languages in the state of Alaska. And I think that, I'll be a co-sponsor.
Both Isaacson and Representative Lynn Gaddis, another Wasilla Republican, said their ancestors had adopted English as their chosen language after coming to the U.S. from Europe. That elicited a strong response from Barrow Democrat Benjamin Nagiak, a fluent speaker of Inupiaq and a co-sponsor of HB 216.
The native people here were not from another country. We were here before.
Representative Charisse Millett, an Anchorage Republican, also offered a passionate defense of the bill. Millett, who says she's a quarter Inupiaq, said she didn't remember as much pushback and questioning when the legislature voted to make the Alaskan Malamute the official state dog. Committee Chair Bob Lynn, an Anchorage Republican, held the bill until next week. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. provimaging.com. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmony goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.